This is the Hugo Award-winning SF Signal Podcast. I'm your host. My name is Patrick Hester, and I'm an author, a blogger, and a functional nerd. And when I do mention the Hugo Award, I get my cookie from John. Tonight, I get to do my favorite thing every month, which is torture Jame.
Yay. Oh, you say it like it's like that's the direction things go.
It is. It totally is. One of these days, Jame, I'm going to somehow get you to agree to do the second volume of that particular anthology. We'll find out. You'll see.
Trust me, you won't.
So this is fun for me because Jame has to do all the heavy lifting. She has to organize all of the authors who are extremely busy and are always having tons of things and tons of pulling on their time and all that kind of good stuff, and who would really rather be writing than sitting on a podcast. So she gets to deal with that. I don't have to.
Woohoo!
Jame. Is that where I'm supposed to introduce myself?
Yes.
Do you want me to do it?
Do you want me to go into the Jame Gates is a...
No. You don't get to introduce me ever.
Okay.
I'm Jame Gates. I am the person who wrangles cats for a living, basically. I'm the communications director for Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, as well as an editor and author. So I will be trying to do questions that make sense, but I have had a very strange day, so I can't promise that they will make sense.
And you have an anthology out there right now, don't you?
Yes, War Stories.
And what's War Stories all about?
Military science fiction. I'm looking at the near future questions of war, like drones and AI and PTSD and exciting things like that.
And who helped you put that together?
Andrew Liptak, and we did it through Apex Publications.
Very cool. Apex is awesome. We love Apex.
Yes, we do.
And what's our topic tonight, Jame?
We'll be talking about the weird today. So that's
you're talking about me?
No. If you aren't running scared already, you should be, because you know our podcasts go a little bit strange anyways, and when our actual subject is the weird, I tremble to think.
And Jame, who did you wrangle for this particular episode?
Well, I'm going to make them introduce themselves.
Okay, but I'm gonna still call on them and make them do it kind of as we're going to tag team them. So let's start with the two people who are sharing a microphone, Anne and Jeff.
Hi, I am Anne Vandermeer. I am an editor anthologist. My latest anthology is The Time Traveler's Almanac, and I also am an acquiring editor for short fiction for Tor.com. My website is weirdfictionreview.com, and my co-editor on my projects is my wonderful husband, Jeff, who will introduce himself.
And I'm Jeff Vandermeer, and I'm the author of the Southern Reach Trilogy, all three books of which were put out this year. I assume that was potentially to make sure that I would expire this year, but in any event, they're out. They failed just barely. And I also have something out called the Steampunk User's Manual. And I'd just like to put a plug in for a story bundle we're doing right now because it helps the Helsinki Worldcon bid. So if you go to Story Bundle, there's a weird fiction bundle that is actually mostly for charity.
No, that's very cool. Is it? What's the website for it?
It's just storybundle.com.
Okay, just a story bundle. Okay, very cool. Next up,
the story bundles are just awesome.
Yeah, I've seen I've seen those quite a bit. Those look very, very cool. It's an opportunity for you to help people and get cool fiction. Next up, let's say hello to Laird.
Hey, guys. Laird Barron here. Really happy to be on the show. I'm a writer of horror, dark fantasy, crime, and noir. And my latest two projects are the collection, The Beautiful Thing That Awaits Us All from Nightshade, and an anthology I co-edited with Michael Kelly called The Year's Best Weird Fiction, which is also available. And you can find me at Twitter, Facebook, or my author site, LairdBarronWordPress.com.
Very cool. And I pronounced it correctly, which is always surprising.
Excellent. Excellent work.
And last but certainly not least, Jim.
Hi, my name is Jim Pavlik. I am an artist, not a writer. I'm currently doing all of the covers for Dark Horse's relaunch of the Eerie comics. And I'm doing a lot of Lovecraft creatures for the Call of Cthulhu RPG.
Very cool. Have you done a lot of comics?
Not a lot, no. I'm just painting the covers for these Eeries. But yeah, that's a great gig.
Very cool. Yeah, I love Dark Horse. Dark Horse is a great imprint. If you're not out there reading some of the Dark Horse stuff, then you're wasting your time. Jame, set the stage.
Yes.
Set the stage.
All right. So, weird is something that has almost by definition, no real definition, which means that being the kind and wonderful host that I am, I'm going to ask everyone to give just a short, not definition, but a short example of what they feel the genre of weird is, and maybe a couple of works that are really good examples of the genre that people either are fairly familiar with or they're just fantastic and everyone should be familiar with. And I will let Patrick choose who we're throwing under the bus first for that.
Well, I think Ann and Jeff have been in this world quite a bit, so they're going to have really, really good answers, so I'm going to make them wait. Let's start with Laird.
Thank you.
Laird.
Yeah. A weird tale. I think it's something that contravenes reality in some essential manner. It's a piece of literature that possesses at least a hint of the alien, and that it emanates disquiet or disorientation.
Do you have a good example of that?
Yeah, I think The Wendigo by Blackwood would be an example. More modern example, completely different direction would be, because I think it's a huge umbrella, despite its niche. A more modern example would be something by, like The Dying Earth by Jack Vance.
Okay. And Jim, what about you?
For me, speaking from a visual sense, the weird is something that is not completely outside the realm of possibility. It takes things that we're used to seeing, you know, like a human form or, you know, just everyday things, but just adds something that you're not used to seeing to that and makes you look at it twice and, you know, give you a little creep. And really great examples of that historically would be artists like Hieronymus Bosch or Henry Fuseli. And more current would be, my favorite would be Wayne Barlow.
Very cool. Jim, by the way, do you sell your art online? Can people go to your website and order stuff?
They can buy originals, yeah.
Good.
At www.jimpavlik.com.
Good, because that's one of the things I always try to check with artists on, is because you guys create such wonderful art, and then I can never find it anywhere, and it drives me up a wall. Now, Anne and Jeff, you guys have been involved with the weird for a really long time. You've done a lot of stuff there, so what's your take on this?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, you have a take as a writer and then as an anthologist.
Sure.
And so, you know, you're kind of categorizing more as an anthologist, and as a writer you try to cast off category to some degree. But basically what we found is, you know, Lovecraft has a standard definition of the weird as being something that's not your standard ghost, not something that's readily identifiable by trope. And so the idea is that the weird is all of that stuff that's uncanny that you can't quite define. And so one of the advantages or the strengths of the weird is that it can never be totally commodified. Like, you're never going to find a weird section in your bookstore. And the very fact that it can't be quite pinned down is actually kind of a strength, even though it also obviously makes people who like to pin butterflies, drives them to distraction. But basically we found, in addition to the Lovecraft definition, that there's also kind of the Kafka definition, which is the weirdness of the real world and this idea of the real world being stranger than you might think. And so in addition to things like Laird Barron's own The Forest, which we have in The Weird, you might also think about things like The Town Manager by Thomas Ligotti or Singing My Sister Down by Margot Lanigan, where you have weird ritual that doesn't always necessarily go into the uncanny, but it feels awfully uncanny. And then also Stephen Graham Jones's Little Lambs, which is a story from 2009 that's absolutely amazing, which kind of combines elements of the uncanny and then also weird rituals. So yeah, it's definitely a category that you can't quite pin down, but you can definitely say you know it when you see it.
The way that I look at weird fiction is I almost see it in some sense, and don't laugh at me, but it's almost like a religious, spiritual phenomenon, because what happens with weird fiction is that there's something going on, something supernatural, and the characters in the story are trying to know the unknowable. And what else is religion or spirituality where you're trying to understand something that you don't understand? And I see weird fiction going in that direction. Most of the time, it tends to the dark side, but it doesn't always have to be, because there is something also beautiful about the grotesque. So for me, when I approach weird fiction, it's more of a seeking of answers, and typically you don't get the answers, but that doesn't matter.
And James, hopefully I'm not stepping on your toes here.
No, go ahead.
I'm curious. A lot of times when you look at other genres like fantasy, there's like Western fantasy. And then you look at science fiction, there's Western science fiction. Is there different kinds of weird for the different areas of the world? Like, is there a Philippine weird that's much, much different than, say, African weird? Or, I mean, does that make sense? I'm kind of asking you, Anne. I'm sorry.
Oh, you're asking me?
I was, yes.
Well, I think that weird fiction is actually a universal thing. You can't really say it belongs in this culture or that culture. But I do think that other cultures might find certain things more natural to their environment than others. Like, for example, when you talk about magic realism and some of the fiction that has come out of South America, a lot of those things, like a man is walking down the street and all of a sudden he starts to fly, that's considered maybe not so weird, you know. But for somebody across the world or somewhere else, they might think of that as being more weird. So in that sense, there might be certain things that one culture might look at stories coming out of another and say, wow, that's really strange and beautiful and weird. Whereas that culture where it came from would say, yes, but this is our daily routine. So
because of the literary tradition that they represent.
Exactly.
Interesting.
And, you know, folk tales and all of those kind of things go along with it as well.
If I could interject.
Sure, Laird, go ahead.
Well, actually, Anne and Jeff both raised a point that I'd thought of in the past, and it's nice that it came up again. One of the definitions of the weird seems to be that it's, or a characteristic, I should say, is that it seems to be personal in a way that other genres aren't. That it's, and that's sort of buttressed by the idea that when Jeff was talking and kind of reaching for a description or trying to articulate one, that he talked about, you know it when you see it. Even though we have some sort of commonality of idea, you know, what it, mm-hmm. of the aesthetic, but it seems like it's a very personal genre. But I have a question for you, Jeff, because you brought this up. Mm-hmm. You talk about the commodification of the weird and also that the weird is sort of intrinsically unidentifiable. Does it remain the weird though once it's identified? In other words, stuff that we're looking at today, and yeah. going, well, that's weird because it doesn't correspond to a traditional ghost story. Well, at one point, a traditional ghost story was anything but. So, does the weird actually outgrow itself?
I think it can, Laird. And a good case in point is we have actually only one vampire story in the weird. It's a Ramsey Campbell story. And it was something where it just was the best story for the anthology, even though we had said we weren't going to have zombies, vampires, and everything else. But in rereading The Weird, even though I knew what was going to happen in that story, because in The Weird there are no other vampire stories, it scared the living shit out of me. And in part it did so because even though on some level I knew what was going to happen in the story, the context of it was different. So that was an example for me of something that's a trope that carries all this baggage with it becoming fresh by the context.
Exactly.
And the flip side of that is that, yes, absolutely, you're absolutely right. And I don't know what the current trope or like strand of the weird would be that is becoming that thing, but I totally agree that it can become that thing, become so identifiable and have so much like backstory to it that
right.
it that it becomes too familiar.
And one more thing, if I might indulge you, or if you'd indulge me, I'm thinking about your mega collect, your omnibus that you put together, The Weird. When you were putting that together, did you find that you selected some of the pieces, even though they might be dated by your aesthetic, or your conception of the weird? Did you read some of these and select them and say, yeah, today they might seem not as shocking or as uncanny, but when they came out, they were probably, you know, quite shocking or quite strange.
Right. I think Anne has an answer
for
this one.
Actually, Laird, when we were reading for this, it was very important to us that every story that we selected for this anthology did read for a modern audience. There was an awful lot of stuff that were considered classics back in the day, but when we read them in context of this anthology, we didn't think that they were going to stand the test of time, so to speak.
Right.
So for us, and this is what was so exciting and wonderful, to be able to read a story that was written 100 years ago and it still really creep you out, to me, that was the thing. That's what we wanted. We wanted something that someone could pick up 100 years from now and still have that same creepy, uneasy feeling that we had reading it today.
But Laird, it's true. It's like there was a story called The Vegetable Man from Italy by Luigi Ugolini. And the fact of the matter is that he wasn't really known for writing weird fiction. He just wrote a lot of stuff. And the opportunity to put that story in from 1917, even though to modern readers it might not be... It's a weird case where it's like it's on the cusp because it reads in a certain way like you'd expect about this guy turning into kind of a tree in a way. But at the same time, we're also on the cusp of all these environmental issues kind of entering into the weird. And so that's a story where you could read it in a totally different way either now or maybe in, you know, 5 years from now.
Well, thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Very cool. Jame, what's next?
All right, so one of the perceptions is that weird is a pretty new genre, but one of the things that I noticed when I was going back through that monstrous doorstop of the best of the weird is that most of the stories were actually fairly old and included some well-known names that I don't know if people necessarily think of as weird. So where does the genre actually start? And did it kind of go quiet for a while and it's now experiencing a resurgence? Or is it something that's just going to kind of go in and out and be a quiet under note in the genre just on a regular basis? And I'll start with
Jim,
Jeff and Ann, since they did the anthologies, and then go from there.
Oh, okay.
I was actually say Laird should field this one first because he's kind of at the forefront.
Okay.
Way.
Laird, come on down.
$1. my take on it, and I actually think this is more for the scholars in the group, but I'll tell you something. Just the sort of conception of the whole thing is that it goes back as far as we've had the desire to tell stories. Uh-huh. I can find the weird as you can find horror, drama, romance, whatever genre you choose in the great religious textbooks. And if it goes back that far, and those were just codifications of oral histories that came before, then obviously this goes back to the Stone Age, back to the Paleolithic. I think you've had, you know, whoever came up with the whole Manitou tale was telling a weird tale. And so I do kind of smile when people talk about it being a new genre. I think it's just a matter of people discover it and they feel like it's new. I think it's hot right now. Maybe not blockbuster, bestseller hot, but definitely I see a lot more activity in the field of the weird. And I feel like at first we were sort of identifying this in the last 10 years or so kind of broadly as a horror renaissance. Mm-hmm. But I actually think with the innovation and the deviation from strict category horror that I see, experimentation and whatnot, and also sort of an emphasis on the uncanny. I do think it's not a renaissance. It's definitely a resurgence. There's a lot of people, relatively speaking, working on the weird right now, and it's very exciting.
Well, it's interesting that you put it that way and talk about how far back it goes, because longtime listeners know that one of my guilty pleasures is Ancient Aliens on the History Channel. And they always manage to come up with these old paintings and art that just depicts aliens and UFOs and all this kind of stuff. And so now I'm wondering if maybe that wasn't just the weird of the time.
Well, the thing of it is, it's like, does weird exist only when someone like Lovecraft notices it? or S.T. Joshi codifies it? Or does it just... You know, I mean, I think
so you're saying it's the silence on Doctor Who?
It's everywhere. It's everywhere. It's infiltrating everything. It's a contamination. I agree with Laird because I know that in our research for various other anthologies, we, you know, even if we're doing a science fiction anthology or we're doing a fantasy anthology, we skew towards the weird to some degree. And there's plenty of examples, you know, before the actual kind of codification of it. And so to me, it's like it's a worldview that permeates a particular writer's or a story by a writer. They're you know, how they perceive things. And that is kind of universal and kind of ongoing. And I like the idea of like going back to these ancient texts and kind of exploring them for the weird content, because some of that stuff is really freaky weird.
Yeah, I mean, how many of you read the Bible? There's
that's a whole bunch weird. Of
yeah.
going
which, on which, in there. Which version?
Book of Revelation.
Any version. Any version. Any Bible.
The Book of Revelation is, I mean, I grew up on that, and I'm fairly sure that that was where I got my love of science fiction and fantasy.
Look at that saying, everything old is new again. So, yes, it's just different generations are rediscovering it, and they think it's the first time, and, you know.
Hold on. So, James, you grew up on the Book of Revelations. This explains so much.
Did you not know that I grew up in a religion
no,
that
I did.
Was
I, but
just...
I didn't know it was Book of Revelations all the time.
Yes, the religion I grew up in was literally founded on the failed prophecies of an 18-year-old girl who prophesied that Armageddon was going to happen in 1844, and when it didn't, they went, well, she was wrong about that, but she's right about everything else, and we're going to follow her, but we're not going to allow women to hold any position in the church or have any rights.
Nice.
And also, Book of Revelations is literal.
Nice.
Can I also yes. say that we still don't know the full ramifications of the weird or other permutations of non-realistic literature, because there's still stuff being translated yes. from other languages, so we don't really have a full view of everything. And every year, new writers are translated, some of them from as far ago, far away as like 50, 60, 70 years ago. And so our view of this keeps changing over time, at least in the English language.
Jim, you've been awfully quiet. Did you want to pipe in here?
I'd like to go back to something somebody said, and ask a question. You're saying, that there seems to be a resurgence in the weird, in literature right now. Is that the case?
Right. That was a Laird here. That's what I said. And I believe so.
Because I'm finding in the art world that it's actually quite stagnant.
Hmm. Why do you think that is, though, Jim?
That's a good question, and I've asked that many times myself. I don't... even when I get assignments in the weird, when I push the boundaries, I get pushed back again. Like, people don't want new weird, they want the same old weird.
So, the Cthulhu type weird.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, even in that, if I do a Cthulhu and I go just a little bit beyond the, you know, a guy that in a squid head costume, you know, I get pushback.
So what you're saying is people have specific expectations of what the weird art should be, and when you go beyond that, they go no, it should be this.
Right.
That's interesting. Right.
And I find that there's just not as many venues for weird art, you know, as there used to be.
Well, what I'm wondering is, do you think it would sell more weird stories if covers on the weird books had the tentacle guy, but he had his back to us and was wearing a shirt that showed off like midriff and had like a little tattoo in the small of his back?
You really should just be executed for that.
Like buff weird.
I'll get you started on the what's going on in book covers right now, because that's a whole different discussion.
Well, I have to confess that for the weird to buy some extra money for permissions, we actually appropriated the cover budget for the book for permissions, and in return, our editor took a picture of the calamari on his plate and superimposed. And superimposed it with a holiday photo of a French cathedral, and that's what the cover is. So that probably is contributing to the degeneration of weird artwork.
Yes, and we apologize.
So it's your guy's fault as much as mine.
Well, Jim, is it just yourself? Have you talked to other artists who are seeing like a trend?
You know, I don't know too many other guys who do as much, you know, weird stuff as I do. But yeah, it seems to be a trend. It seems to be that the decision that we're making is it makes more sense to do our own thing and do Kickstarters and stuff like that than to go the traditional publishing route.
Okay.
But yeah.
All right. So actually, go ahead.
I was going to say, and you know, the every once in a while I will find a venue that I think, oh, this will be great. And they, of course, have no money to pay anybody. So that's also discouraging.
I can see where that would be very discouraging. Yes. I mean, not getting paid for the work you do, it's almost like you're a podcaster. Go ahead, Jane.
So I actually wanted to, we already started touching on it, but I wanted to talk about weird art and talk about some of the influence of comics. You know, we are seeing some really odd, strange, lovely stuff there. I have Jim's own project, which I think is fascinating, but also just how much weird visual comes out of, I think, religion. I'm going back to some of the mystic texts about demons and gods and the things there, it seems like we see a lot of that actually filtering over into weird and providing really great templates there. So I just want to talk a little bit about who some of the weird artists are and some of the challenges of portraying something that's not usual or really something that people are expecting or possibly even enjoying seeing at first.
And who would you like to answer that?
We'll go with Jim.
So, Jim, take it away.
Well, obviously, like you were saying, the influence of religion is huge. You know, your Book of Revelations and all that. And then when Milton did Paradise Lost, and Gustave Doré did the illustrations for that, that was a big deal for artists since him, you know, to see depictions of Lucifer and stuff like that. Nobody had really done anything that large of scale before. So that kind of set the ball in motion. And then when you get to today, most of the really weird stuff is more, I would say, more fine art than illustration. So guys like Giger and Polish guy who just died recently named Władysław Bekszynski. He was really the most weird, I guess, if I can say that. The one that all of us weird artists kind of flock to for inspiration on really pushing the boundaries, mm-hmm. you know, of what you could do with paint and make things really creepy and atmospheric and disturbing. Yeah, he's one of the best.
Very cool. Anne?
Well, Jeff and I are very fortunate that we live in Tallahassee, Florida, the home of Florida State University that has an really, amazing professor.
And really, really big bugs.
Yeah, well, an amazing professor and artist by the name of Carrie Ann Botta. And a couple of years ago, she curated a show here at FSU. It was the most well-attended show ever in the history of the university, called Cute and Creepy. And every single artist that contributed to that exhibit, I would consider to be a weird artist. And a lot of them were artists that I had worked with on Weird Tales and other projects. But if you have not looked at Carrie Ann Botta's work, B-A-A-D-E, you should look her up. And for sure, there were also people like Chris Mars and Travis Louie, they're amazing artists, Richard A. Kirk, Laurie Field, Jessica Joslin, and we're talking about all different types of art, not just painting, but also sculpture, fabric art, and multimedia. Judith Schachner does a lot of work with glass, and that show was just mind-blowing for the audience here. They had from babies in arms all the way to people in their 80s, and they were thrilled to see that type of art. So right. I think if you actually have it out there.
They didn't actually identify it as weird artists. which is pretty key. It's like to find a lot of the really cool stuff. It's writers, it's artists who are identifying as surreal or even horror artists.
So they gave it a different label in order to make it palatable.
Called it cute and creepy.
Yeah. And that actually was one of the most exhibits they ever did.
The overall movement that those guys are kind of lumping themselves in with is the lowbrow movement, you know, that gets a lot of play in magazines like Juxtapose and High Fructose. Right.
That's true.
But, yeah, Chris Mars and Travis Louie and Chet Czar, those guys are all fine artists, so they're making all their sales in galleries as opposed to in publishing. So that's kind of what I was saying, is like if you're really going to push the envelope, you have to do it on your own. That, you know, publishing really isn't the place for you.
Yeah, I think I actually think that also that book covers in genre have gotten more and more conservative in general. And so that kind of also kind of proves your point to some degree, which is that you have to, and then there's that degree of risk in that you have to do a lot of stuff that you're not doing on commission in order to push past that.
Can I also put a plug in for tor.com? If you've looked at some of the art that's come out there, I know that some of the art that's illustrated the stories that I've acquired there have been amazing.
And does Irene have anything to do with that?
Yes, Irene is the art director. She is the one that does all Irene of that. Gallo.
Irene Gallo is awesome. Yes. I love her to death.
Take a look at some of those artists.
Irene would never use me. She is great, but she would never use me in a million years.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I have a question. So I have a theory on my own about book covers and why they look the way they do. But I'm curious, Jeff, you said you think they're getting more conservative. Why do you think that is?
I think that there are many positive things about what you might call paranormal romance being redefined as urban fantasy, but one of the negative things is this idea that all covers have to be some representation of human beings in certain poses. And so the variety begins to break down as a result of that. And I think we see that in science fiction and fantasy a lot. If you go to the science fiction and fantasy section of Barnes & Noble, you're mostly going to see a variety of human beings in various poses with guns or swords or whatever else.
Right, but is that because... So what I wonder, though, is isn't that just an extension of publishing as a whole in that when a story works and hits, they want 10,000 more just like it?
To some degree. But, you know, back when New Weird hit, and you can debate whether there was such a thing as New Weird or not, but it was a publishing category for a while. There was a lot of non-representational stuff. If you look at Bantam's covers back then, they're very much more design-oriented and not so much with having someone's face on it. So definitely there's been a shift in that. And there's also a shift if you look at science fiction fantasy that's published by mainstream imprints. They don't really do the same things. They use a lot more design-heavy stuff that doesn't necessarily have to be representational to a scene in the book. And I think that does make a difference in how the stuff is perceived and the kinds of freedoms that an artist can have.
And when I mentioned the extension of publishing, Anne, you said no? Do you disagree?
No, I didn't say that.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said no. That's okay.
But, I mean, I have to be honest. Like, even and not to bring in the Southern Reach too much, but, you know, any genre publisher would have put dark dystopian covers on that, and they would have sold probably a third of what they sold from Ferris, Strauss, and Giroux, who put bright, kind of almost neon covers on them that were probably more... geared towards having a mainstream reader in addition to a genre reader pick them up, and yet they're the same weird book regardless of what you think of them. They're definitely not the norm, and so I think that, you know, this is an issue in terms of art, in terms of artists who are commissioned for book covers.
Well, and those covers stand out. I mean, that's part of the reason why.
Yes.
Right. I mean, they definitely stand out. They look different, and yet I think they draw people's eye and make them want to pick up those books. Jane, what's next?
So one of the things that keeps getting brought up is the genre versus the non-genre. So where do things like magical realism and the weird intersect? And is it a kind of a gateway to non-genre readers and introducing them to some of the genre sorts of things?
And Laird, you've been kind of quiet. You want to take that one first?
Well, I don't know if you can really point to it being a gateway at all. I think actually, if we're going to talk about gateways, you have to have something that's commercially successful, brightly packaged. And I think Jeff's series would fulfill that. You've got to draw them in some way. And a lot of the stuff that I see being published, like a lot of the stuff that I selected for Michael Kelly's, the inaugural Year's Best Weird Fiction, would definitely not be, I don't think necessarily gateway stuff at all. I'm not really sure what a gateway story would be, except something that has been promoted and packaged in such a way as to get a lot of eyes on it.
Very cool. Jim, do you think there's such a thing as gateway art?
Yeah, I would say so. For me, you know, I started looking at comic books at a very young age. And then once you get into comics and, you know, some of the D&D artists, you start to learn about the illustrators that came before them, you know, the illustrators of the Golden Age, like Howard Pyle and N.C. Wyatt. And then you can just keep following that timeline back, you know, to the all the way to the Renaissance. So, yeah, you can start a gateway thing like comics or, you know, like Mike Mignola or somebody like that and work your way all the way back to Rembrandt.
Very cool. Anne?
Well, I think that you can also take a look at the element of the weird being in different types of fiction. Like, for example, I tend to like weird in all of my fiction. So when I read science fiction, I like it to be the weird kind. When I read fantasy, I like it to be the weird kind. When I even read romance, I like it to be the weird kind. So I think what? that well, you know what I mean. You know what I mean. I mean, I tend
I
to
Well, if you didn't before, you do now.
I tend to lean more towards that. And I think it was because I was raised on all of the Wizard of Oz books, and those are some really weird books. You know, the first book, yes, of course, we all know that story. But if you read some of the other books, they're pretty strange. And because I was raised with that as a child, I always tend to look for the weird in wherever I go. So as far as what would be a gateway for that, I think what Laird said is perfectly acceptable. You know, you find something that's highly commercial and successful, and if people glom on to that, then they're going to want what's the next thing and what's the next thing.
Well, the perfect example is probably True Detective, which led a lot of readers to Thomas the Gaudy.
Exactly.
One way or the other. And it may have been disappointing for some readers of Uncanny Fiction when True Detective wound up to just be using it thematically. it still left a mark, but also an imprint that other people were able to kind of pick up and run with. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that. I mean, the idea that Ligotti somehow sells out by trading off of True Detective is one of the more hilarious things I can think of, because he's very deeply uncommercial.
Well, I just want to add one thing. I think that gateway can be a useful term. I just resist it, at least instinctually, because it implies, you start with the weak shit and you move to the strong. So in other words, you know,
you read gotta some cut of that it weak, with something first.
Right. You read some of that weak ass Mignola and then you move on to the real stuff. And I'm just like, which I know that's not what Jim's intending, but the point is that's how people.
And eventually you get to Cisco.
Hold on.
You're unadulterated.
Did you just diss Hellboy?
Well,
I think that's what I heard.
No, I'm saying that Jim was dissing Hellboy by.
I would never diss Hellboy.
I'm actually the one who is dissing Hellboy by that standard, and Hellboy is one of my favorites. So I resent that insinuation, sir.
No, but the movies are different from the comics too.
Mignola, yes. Mignola is it's nobody's gateway, is all I'm saying. And the idea being that if we're going to look at the weird as an artifact in of itself, then I'm not sure what the gateway would be. I do agree with the thesis that you can use stories or other artifacts that contain elements of the weird and kind of dip your toe in. That's fine, because
Gone Girl is not a gateway drug for the weird. Sorry.
Well, I just don't like any kind of a term. I resist any kind of a term that sort of, by definition, denigrates.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you ease in with this. And I'm like, no, that's bullshit. I don't like that.
Well, let me explain a little more specifically why I'm calling it that. A lot of weird can take place in our world. So you have people who maybe are interested in that sort of thing, but aren't necessarily sure that they will pick up a full fantasy book, or who read Gabriel Garcia Marquez because it's packaged as literature and not as science fiction and fantasy. And when I'm talking about a gateway, maybe I'm talking more about a crossover where, like Jeff's books, it can be packaged to a mainstream audience and thereby reaches people who may have that interest but never even knew that they had it or knew where to look for it.
Well, I think it's definitely true to subject matter. Like, for example, I was very fortunate in that I happened to be writing books that were about a strange wilderness where something had gone wrong and they're sending expeditions. And I've literally had this conversation that I've had before with the Ambergris books, which were much weirder in a way, in an airport, literally in Kansas, with a little old lady who reads mostly Tom Clancy. And usually that conversation goes really badly. Like, they ask me what I write. It's like, well, it's about weird mushroom people and they live in this underground place in this messed up city. And it's like, I can see the eyes glazing over. So I was fortunate in that I could say it's about an expedition into a pristine wilderness where something has gone terribly wrong. Yes, it gets weirder from there, but I had the advantage of the initial setup being much easier to explain. And so that was an advantage. And that's not an advantage you have for all kinds of weird fiction. It's not really a gateway thing. It's just the situation of your particular novel at a particular point in time.
And did that little old lady, did she say, oh, that sounds like Clear and Present Danger?
She she didn't, but she didn't glaze over. And she did say she'd pick up the book. Now, whether she did or not, and whether it turned out to be a 5-star Amazon review or one of those 1-star burn in hell ones, I don't know.
But those are the best kind, aren't they?
And as far as gateway goes, I think ease of accessibility to me would help define a gateway thing. So, like as I was saying, when I was a kid, it was much easier to get a hold of a comic book than it was to see, you know, a work of art at the Art Institute. You know, I couldn't just, at 12 years old, go to the Art Institute easily.
Well, obviously the comic book store was closer to your house than it was to mine, because I had to go all the way to Clovis.
Yeah, it was pretty close to my house, so that's, you know, to me,
Patrick, that's what happens when you live in Fresno.
Yep.
This is at a point when comics were being carried in grocery stores and stuff, so, you know, if I went to the grocery store with my mom and helped her shop and I got done quickly, I could run over to the comics and look at the comics, and that to me was the gateway, just because it was easier to get to as opposed to making some kind of qualitative judgment on the work.
Well, I think comics are a great place for anybody to start, because there's so much great things going on. If you kind of get away from the mainstream DC and Marvel stuff and you get into Vertigo and Dark Horse and different areas, I think you can find a lot of really cool things.
Yeah, I mean, I started off with Conan, which, you know, takes you to Howard, and that takes you to Lovecraft, and then you're off and running.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Laird?
I was going to say, I loved comics when I was a kid, but didn't have access to them, so I didn't come to Howard at the age of 8 through comics. I came to Howard at the age of 8 through Howard. So I guess I'm coming at it from somebody who actually probably came at it a little differently than the average kid. I was reading all that stuff when I was 7, 8 years old. So, you know, we lived in a very remote place up in Alaska, and we had what we had. We took several steamer trunk loads of books up there, and it was everything from Barbara Cartland romances to Clavell to Howard and Lovecraft and Poe. And so from a very young age, I was reading that stuff. So I have a tendency to have a pretty high standard for kids getting into stuff. I love comics. I think Kirby is a god, or was a god, but I also think we sell kids very short by not just saying, hey, here's Howard, here's Lovecraft, sit down and read it, and give me a book of work.
See, I read G.I. Joe, and they had Serpentor. I had no idea I was reading the weird. Anne.
Yes.
Do you have anything to add on this?
About gateways?
Yes.
Well, one of the things I was thinking about as I was listening to y'all talk is that sometimes the gateway is a different form of media. Sometimes the gateway might be like a movie. Hmm. You see a movie because those are easily more accessible to a lot of people and people are talking about it. And maybe that can lead you to something else. So I could see it that way, too.
Do you have a suggestion? Sometimes
that's sometimes the easiest way to describe something. Well, it's kind of like this. It's kind of like that. You know, and you're just, it's like when Jeff was talking about True Detective, something that you can watch on TV, something that you see on the screen. And if you mention that, people know exactly what you're talking about because everyone's heard of it, even if they haven't seen it. So that type of thing.
If you guys thought that True Detective helped people find Chambers and Lovecraft and Bierce, that kind of stuff, do you think that there was a...
There was definitely a spike in sales, yeah.
It did, and it ultimately disappointed them, too.
But this entry point for readers, I mean, if you look at the way Kafka is even packaged these days, again, with bright covers, I think Peter Mendelsohn did some Kafka covers, but the point is this entry point is so important that the actual stuff doesn't change, but sometimes that entry point is really important as to how the reader perceives it. And I personally don't have any stake in how something's packaged, you know, as to making some kind of philosophical stand, you know. So I think maybe a little more imagination in that way would open up some things to readers that they might not otherwise be receptive to. Also, Jim, I have to say, I'm stalking you on Google right now, and this stuff is absolutely amazing. It's really awesome.
Oh, thank you.
It really... I actually found Jim through the recent Kickstarter that he did and snapped up both books, and they are absolutely lovely, and I'm really glad you two are meeting, because I think that there is a lot of mutual... So I actually have one last question that Anne led into brilliantly, because I wanted to briefly talk about the alternate media and its relation with the weird and how well it works for visual mediums like film, even radio plays, games, that sort of thing. So I'm going to start with Jim because he can talk about games specifically and possibly other things as well.
Okay. The weird is great in gaming. I mean, it's infinite, you know, the amount of creatures and stuff that these game companies want to come up with. But again, I find that they don't want to see the full expression of it. There's a lot of reining in that goes on in the creative process in gaming. But, I mean, yeah, it's there. It's all over the place. I just wish that sometimes these companies would trust the artists to do their thing more.
I think sometimes doesn't it cross over a little bit into horror?
Yeah. I mean, it's all really closely tied in gaming. You know, if you're running... you know, like a Paizo campaign, a fantasy campaign, you can bring in all different kinds of horror elements and weird elements to even your just regular fantasy campaign.
What about video games?
Yeah, there's a ton of weird in video games, you know, with Silent Hill and...
Oh, Silent Hill. I loved that game. The first one? Oh.
Yeah. They did a really good job, and I think there's probably a lot more freedom there to really do some unique and bizarre stuff.
And if you truly want to waste 2 hours of your time, go watch that stupid fucking movie.
No, actually, that movie, considering everything, that movie was not bad. When you consider...
It's better than Transformers 4.
It's exactly... I mean, it had some really creepy stuff in there.
It did.
I didn't know anything about the game when I saw that movie. Now, of course, yes, certain things were like typical, traditional, blah, blah, blah. But considering that it was a movie based on a video game, I thought they did a pretty decent job. So there you go. Hate me if you want.
I think he's going to hate you.
That's okay. That's okay.
I think he might be lost for words, actually, which is a new one for Patrick.
It was a terrible movie.
He's heaving sighs.
It was a terrible movie.
I think he might be crying.
Okay, but you got to understand that one of my all-time favorite movies is Ernest Goes to Camp.
Oh God! Don't even bring. Please don't. That's some weird shit. Sorry.
As a fellow horrible movie lover, Anne, I completely support you in this.
But I will also say that a recent movie that I saw that I thought kind of fit this whole weird thing that I absolutely loved was Birdman. I love that movie.
That is supposed to be an amazing movie. That yes, that is supposed to be a really good.
I thought it was amazing, and I thought it was really weird because you don't really know what's going on.
Right.
Babadook is supposed to be good, too.
Yes. Plan on seeing that soon.
So, who's next, James? Who else did you want to torture about this?
Well, I think we're running out of time.
We are,
yes. So if everyone's good, I think we can do last.
Okay, let's do last thoughts. So final thoughts on all of this stuff, Jeff.
I just want to put in a plug for Caitlin Kiernan, who I think has consistently written some of the best stuff for the last 25 years, and not always been recognized for it. Although she was finally at the World Fantasy Awards this year, so I just want to put in a plug for her.
Oh well, then I'm going to put in a plug for Michael Sisko. I published his first book, The Divinity Student, back in the 90s, and he is, as far as I'm concerned, an underrated writer. I don't think that people of weird fiction, and he is a master of it. So, Michael Sisko.
Very cool. Laird?
I'll follow suit. Livia Llewellyn.
Yes.
Brilliant. She brings the brutality and the eroticism in spades to the weird genre, and I think you guys should go out and check her out.
Very cool. Jim?
Yeah, I'll keep the tradition going here. The best guy out there doing weird stuff right now is a guy named Alan Williams. He is amazing. And he's done stuff for Tor.
Oh, very cool. James?
Mostly just that weird fiction is a genre wonderfully relevant to the short form, and check out Jeff and Anne's Weird for a really good look at some of the stories that built the genre and are either some of the ones that we all grew up on, or some absolutely beautiful ones that will probably be your new favorites.
Very cool. Jeff and Anne, any upcoming conventions or places where people can see you guys live?
We're going to be in Amsterdam in February.
I'm recovering from 5 months on the road, so.
It's actually a conference called Geological Imagination in Amsterdam. It's the last weekend in February.
And it will involve the weird. Yeah.
Yes.
In a geological
way. That's awesome. Yeah.
Very cool. Laird, anywhere you're going to be where people can come up and say hey?
Necronomicon, August 2015. Probably my next appearance.
At the Necronomicon.
Very cool. Jim, how about you? You going to do any art shows at any cons?
My next show is actually a tattoo convention at Navy Pier in July, I believe.
Very cool. Do you do tattoos as well?
No, but I'm finding that audience is very receptive to the weird work. So I'm pursuing those kind of conventions as opposed to the traditional comic and gaming convention.
Very cool. Very awesome. Well, James, what about you? You going anywhere?
I don't have anything until April when I will be at the East Coast Game Conference. And like Jeff, I am recovering from months on the road. So I am very much looking forward to not going anywhere. But I thought of something that I meant to say earlier and forgot. I am actually currently in the town that Clark Ashton Smith wrote most of his non-high fantasy short stories, Placerville, California, Old Haintown, and that's where I grew up. So awesome. For me, the weird goes a long ways back in my life.
That's awesome. Well, I want to thank everybody for coming on tonight. This has been a great conversation. Go check out, we'll have links on the post so you can get to everybody's websites. And just thanks for coming on, folks.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Cheers.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Hugo Award-winning SF Signal podcast.
Your host is Patrick Hester, an author, a blogger, and a functional nerd. His website is www.atfmb.com, which stands for All Things From My Brain. ATFMB is also his Twitter handle and where you can find him on Facebook. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the links to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com or search SF Signal in iTunes. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and have them tell their friends and so on and so on. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all of your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal regulars offer up new content every day, from weekly mind melds featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SF and F field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, fiction deals, movie reviews, videos, links and roundup posts, and more. Click the RSS button in the sidebar of your browser to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Angry robot.
It's like talking to a child.
Magic wooey.
Wah, wah.
Thinking and crap.
And scene.